Same. But this is actually very impoverished. There's no measures, no probabilities, none of that. What it's about is I'll start off, let's see, from a certain perspective, what it's about is that Turing machines and the Chomsky hierarchy, frankly, strike me as a very ugly model to presume that physical reality is concerned about them, strikes me as a bit of a leap. So what I was interested in doing with the whole sort of it from the Wheeler thing is to try to investigate what does a information processing, in the broadest sense, process amount to for real physical systems. Let's not start with our mathematical models, but look at what's really going on in the most simple notions. It's got nothing to do even with physics, in a certain sense, what it means to observe, predict, or to remember. In the language of philosophy of science, this is actually almost more a matter of a formal epistemology than anything else. When one formalizes those three processes, and also similar ones like control, one finds that even a very minimal formalization, there is an underlying mathematical structure that they all have in common. All of those processes are actually different versions of the same thing. You can formalize that mathematically, and I call such things inference devices. They've got a whole bunch of elementary properties along the lines of things like, even in a finite, classical, non-chaotic universe, Laplace was wrong. He could not have predicted the future unerringly with 100% accuracy. They, in another version I'll get to a little bit further down, they will actually tell you that you cannot make two observations, to have two separate observation devices that are observing different things, we are guaranteed that both were 100% accurate, which is, sounds very, very similar to something like the impossibility of, it has to do with the impossibility of measuring momentum and position at the same time. They've also got a lot of characteristics that overlap with the Chomsky hierarchy. So it's not the Chomsky hierarchy, it's an alternative. It's got some mathematical structure that's very related. And so I'll spend a good deal of time actually talking about that down here. In particular, you can define a version of algorithmic information complexity using these inference devices. That's called inference complexity. And amongst other things, whereas algorithmic information complexity, the way that people normally try to introduce the notions from Turing machine into statistical physics, while it has this nasty property that it is arbitrary depending on the choice of Turing machine, inference complexity would be unique. And then at the end, I'll get a little bit into what happens if you throw a measure space on underneath things, and so on and so forth. So please interrupt me as I go along. I'm going to couch things in the very simplest of formulation. Just think classical non-relativistic physics. There's time going left to right, and there's some single-dimensional real value variable that's all the universe going down. And so we have some system going off to the right, and at some time t2, we want to observe. We want to know what is its state at time t2. Well, it turns out if you think about what's happening there, it's actually a bit of a complicated thing. And this is as simplified as I've been able to make it and still capture the salient details. I'm only the messenger. Don't blame me. The message is itself a little bit messy. But here's what we actually do if you think about it. We have an external observation apparatus. That's too big to hold. And at some time t1 before t2, we prepare our observation apparatus, telling you what we want to observe and so on and so forth. Then we presume there's some kind of physical coupling between our apparatus and the system between T1 and T2. And then goes on afterwards, and at T3, we actually look at our observation apparatus, and that is our observation, that's the result. So there are three actual variables involved there. The setup of the apparatus at A of T1, the conclusion of the apparatus of the device at T3, and then what we actually want to know, S of T2, okay? Now, here's where the first point, and perhaps the most major point, where it extends beyond conventional physics, Everett kinds of notions of what it means to observe. I'm going to state, or if you want to view it in a way, simply explore the ramifications of the view that just having a correlation even if it's 100% correlation between the output of the observation device, what is it you want to observe, does not constitute an observation. So you have a very, very, very simple example. If I've got a camera that's looking at a tree in a forest, and it's going to some, I want to observe whether that tree falls or not, but the image on the camera is encrypted, and I can't decrypt it, I don't have a decryption algorithm, then there could be perfect correlation on that camera image. But in a certain sense, it's useless. As a practical observation, I've learned nothing. There's more going on there than an observation. From the point of view of information theory, what's going on is that the actual image on the camera has to have semantic meaning and not just syntactic meaning. It's got to actually mean something to us and not just have that strong correlation. The difficulty is how to figure out how to formalize semantic meaning to allow us to say what observation is. Question?
Can you just say there's no correlation?
No, there's a perfect correlation. Whatever that snow that I'm seeing on my camera screen is perfectly correlated with whether the tree falls up or not. If the tree stands up, there's going to be one completely undecipherable image, and if the tree falls, there'll be another one. Just I don't know which is which.
If I'm tracing out the key, I mean, if I don't look at the key, then there's no correlation.
No, statistically, physically, statistically, there is going to be a correlation. It's just that I can't make use of it if I don't know the key. So physically, it's always going to be the case in every single universe, consistent with the laws of physics, if the tree falls, then there's this image, and if the tree does not fall, then there's that image.
So maybe what I would say is that so the S is correlated with A3 and the key, but it's not correlated with just A3.
If you average over all possible keys or something, you might say that there's no correlation.
If you take the key to be a physical system and you trace out the key, then you're left with a state for the two that's just uncorrelated.
Yes, sure, of course. But the point is that I, as an actual user, don't know what that key is. Right. So I don't know how to trace it out, in essence. But it's a very practical, mundane issue. It's just simply saying that there's no semantic meaning. That if there is that key there, I just looking at a statistical correlation will actually not make it any useful for me. So here is what that key would actually allow us to do, if we did have the key. We could, or here's another way of phrasing it. What is a way of treating this issue in general of what is a key? So I don't want to only consider encryption with particular kinds of keys and so on. I want to consider things from a more general perspective. Here is what I would say it needs to actually have semantic information. If you've got to introduce somebody who's actually using the observation device, that's the crucial thing. In a certain sense, this is actually the collapse of a wave packet and an external observer coming back in a certain sense. You've got an external scientist, a PowerPoint art geek like that one there. And what it means for this fellow to be able to know that the observation has taken place, that he can say this. Let's say that A of T3 says S of T2 equals K. In other words, that's what the actual key is going to tell us. He can then answer the binary question, does S of T2 equal K? Moreover, if it's still saying S of T2 equals K, he can actually answer another binary question, does it equal K prime? This time he'll say no. And he can do that for K double prime and so on and so forth. So in other words, the semantic meaning is being introduced here by having this external scientist be able to read the state of the apparatus and answer every possible such binary question of what does it actually mean. Now, in a certain sense so far, I haven't actually necessarily gotten anywhere because I still don't know what it means to answer it. But that's where the notion of successful observation will come in. Successful observation is going to mean that these answers actually line up with the truth. Question?
Your statement was that it's not enough to just look for correlation, that we need a deeper notion here. We need to look at the semantic meaning.
Yes.
So I think the information theorists, at least the quantum information theorists in the room, would say that within that we have a theory in which actually just correlation actually does capture exactly what, and I don't want to argue that. Mm-hmm. What I want to know is, should I worry about this? In other words, if if our theory really does capture what you're talking about just within the framework of correlation without semantic meaning, then is that sort of a big issue for the rest of your talk, or should I just stop worrying and learn to love Quant?
What I would say right now is that if this can be, no, because this is not presuming quantum mechanics. This is more fundamental. And there's these tentative notions from the end, in fact, that this kind of work might be able to give some insight into quantum mechanics. It's also more general than even the notion of the key. I am not writing down any specific encryption scheme. I'm not even saying that by itself the encryption is what's going on. But the perspective here is a different one. It's saying that there is no actual key in this universe. Shouldn't have actually used those phrases even, given that we're information theorists nowadays. It's simply saying, I have a universe, and nothing about keys. I'm just simply pointing out that this universe is a set of possible world lines consistent with the laws of physics. And it just so happens that in every single one of those world lines, the image on the camera is going to be exactly this when the tree on that world line has fallen, and it will be exactly that when the tree in the world line has fallen. That's true for every world line consistent with the law of physics. Nothing about a key anywhere. What I'm saying is just the fact that we do therefore have that correlation in that sense. I'm not even talking about traces now, just in that sense that these two variables always covary in every possible world line consistent with the law of physics. That by itself does not suffice, or it can be argued, I mean, to not be so strong in my statement, that one can simply explore the ramifications of the claim that there is more to a meaningful observation than simply noting that in every possible universe consistent with the laws of physics, these two variables are lined up the following way. The number of degrees of freedom is actually one rather than two. So no keys are even involved here that I'm actually going to trace over or anything else. Does that help to?
Just to clarify, so the semantic meaning, is it like just a map from these A's, like the configuration of your camera thing, to the collection of answers to all the questions?
Yes, I'm going to actually do that formalization in a couple of slides. In the back?
Don't you need a third apparatus to read it out A-T-3 and so on?
The scientist has to actually be able to read it, yes, and I'll get to that.
So you need more apparatuses after A?
Actually, you're going to be able to close the loop, so to speak, in the brain of the scientist. I'll show how.
I can't just keep A then as well.
And the formalism will actually allow that, yes. Okay. I'm using this as a motivation for the actual formal structure. Okay? So I hope I addressed the question about the keys. Now, I don't even need a key in this physical universe.
I just want to say one thing. I get this sort of very recursive feeling here, right? Because what if the scientist thinks it, was, it right? Okay.
Yes, and I'm going to show how to close the loop.
Okay.
Exactly so. Okay, so that was observation. Now I'm going to investigate prediction. Again, a very, very simplified universe. There's some system. And I want to know its state at T2. Say, for example, it's, the stock market. I might know its value next week for who knows what peculiar reasons. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to run my laptop or a program on to try to make that prediction. So what does that mean I'm actually going to do? At some time before T2, I'm going to noodle away at these keys. I'm going to thereby set up the program that the laptop is then going to run. Crunch, 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 hopefully before T2, my laptop is going to pop up with some number on its screen, and that's the answer. So again, you have three different variables. You have the computer is set up at T1, you have that's a setup, it makes its conclusion at T3, and then there's what you wanted to actually predict, which is the state of the system at T1. Now again, for example, when we're predicting the stock market, I would say that just having the output of my laptop covary, if you prefer that I use that word rather than correlate, with the state of the stock market next week does me no good. This program comes through and it pops out the answer and says that the value of the stock market next week is going to be A gamma underscore 2,3. Well, it doesn't matter if in every single possible universe consistent with the laws of physics, that particular output of my laptop only occurs when the value of the stock market is 11,206. I can't make use of it. I need to have more. There's no semantic information. Correlation in that sense does not suffice to actually have the prediction be made. So even no matter whether the prediction is correct or not, that in a certain sense hasn't even been made. I have got to, again, getting back to this distinction information between semantic and syntactic information, I've got to figure out how to imbue A of T3 with semantic meaning. Play the exact same game for, okay, how do you do that? Well, pop in the person using this laptop. Notice, by the way, that this supposition of somebody who's using the observation apparatus or using the computer, it's not sort of arbitrary. In everything that we think about, when we do prediction or observation some such, there is this person, there is the scientist, namely us. So there is actually always this third creature involved. I'm not just sort of making it up and I'm inserting it that way. So what the scientist does to give semantic meaning to that prediction of their laptop, that what that means is that they can take any possible binary value question, is my laptop saying that the state of the stock market is going to be 11,206 next week? And if that is in fact what it is saying, the scientist, me, can answer yes. While at the same time, if the question is the value of the stock market going to be 12,000, according to the prediction, they're going to say, according to the prediction, no. And then they're asked, and so on and so forth. And so again, semantic meaning comes in the head of this external scientist because they can answer any binary value question about what is being predicted, about the prediction being made, let me be more careful, for any possible state of the external predicting apparatus, they can answer the question of, is it actually saying this, that, or the other? Question.
Why is the one thing semantic meaning and not the other? I mean, you in a sense have an event which can be correlated with the joint thing, so the encryption and the laptop.
Mm-hmm.
And why is one thing, I mean, in order to read this thing, you need to bring both things together. You can't just look at the encrypted, the key, you can't just look at the laptop and the So it's correlated with the joint thing, so I need to see the key and the laptop. So it's jointly correlated with the two things. But why is one thing providing, I mean, in some sense, is it, are you making...
Let me actually then flip it around this way. I will claim that in any instance of observation or prediction that we might actually all agree is such an instance, this property holds. So whether, I don't want to get bogged down on whether this is actually going to do with keys, which I don't think it does, or semantic information. I'm simply myself noting as a scientist that whenever we do predict something, whenever I'm using my computer and I predict the state of the world, it pops out an answer, I am able to actually answer all these questions concerning what it's saying. Similarly, when I look at my digital camera that's making an observation, I am able to answer all those questions, what's on the screen. Whether I'm doing it with keys and this, that, and the other, that's material. From this perspective, let me leave it at that point and say that this is actually a characteristic that happens to be there every time we do something we call prediction, every time we do something that we call observation. That we always, as the user of the apparatus, can go through this exercise. And that has implications, major ones. That's all I'll illustrate. Chris?
Is this maybe an overly simplified way to put it? Suppose I give you the number 42.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, here, you've got the number 42. Do you have the answer to something? Well, only if you have a question in mind. So by interacting your apparatus with the system, just having perfect correlation doesn't signify that you've got the answer to anything.
It's not actionable intelligence, so to speak.
Does that capture the essence of
that? That captures my motivation. But again, I'll actually say that even though I agree with that, one doesn't even need to invoke it. One can simply observe that this is always true. People can always answer any such thing in anything that they call prediction observation.
I'm sorry to ask so many questions, but just Chris, I'm a little worried. It's, you're saying you have to have a specific question in mind in order for the answer to make any sense, but I feel like David's saying something slightly different, which is the semantic meaning here is a kind of a dictionary that allows me, given that dictionary, I can answer any question. And that's not a specific question. There seems to be a slight but important
difference. Yes. You are exactly correct. What Chris is actually, his comment, what it relates to is, as you'll see in a couple of slides, there is implicitly a question within the head of the scientist. So I'll get to that. But let me then just sort of, to try to avoid these issues, simply state as this is something that I will strongly claim is always characteristic of anything you would call a prediction or observation. We, as the users of the device, always can do that. Whether we call that semantic meaning or not is semantics. One more question.
So it seems there's two different ways to interpret a statement like does S of T2 equal L. So one way would be that you suppose there's some real map, there's some real fact of the map, some sort of underlying ontology, and it's a statement of that nature.
Yes.
The other would be to say, well, no, there's actually some alternative way of probing the system S, and under that alternative way of probing it, you would find that S of T2 equals L. So you mean the first?
Well, actually, what this scientist is simply saying is, does my observation apparatus say that this is what S of T2 equals? Nothing so far about it being correct.
Okay.
Then there's going to be another possibility of whether it's correct or not.
Okay.
And it's going to be the relationship between those that are going to give a whole bunch of impossibility results, saying that there are certain kinds of things that you cannot observe ever, and certain things you cannot predict ever, and things along those lines. And that will then lead into the Chomsky hierarchy stuff. Okay? All right, let's try to go a little more quickly now. Memory. Memory is retrodiction. It's prediction about the past. It's taking some current data and inferring something about the past rather than inferring something about the future. So it's going to follow along with the same game. If I have a memory in my computer, and that's my system S, and I want to be able to recall that event at some previous time T2, then what we do is we hope that there's been some coupling between that memory system and the system being remembered and the memory device. And then at A of T1, I say what I want to know is S of T2. And then at A of T3, I hopefully am able to read out the correct thing. And again, for that memory to be useful, correlation is not the all, or at least in the real world when we use these devices, it's not the all. That we can instead go through and answer all these questions about what is it my memory is actually saying. Okay. So now let me sort of formalize all that stuff and extract what's common. So I hope that'll address some of these questions. Here is the mathematics that I think hopefully will clarify it all. All of these things, the crucial point where you get all kinds of the diagonalization proofs and so on, is that all of this is going on in the same physical universe. The system S exists in the physical universe. Therefore, its state of time T is just a function of the universal rule of nine. It's a projection. And we can just write that down as some function gamma of U. So that was the first thing, the obvious point. That was the first one of the variables that arose. Now, at the same time, the observation apparatus exists in the universe. And therefore, it is a projection of the universal rule of nine. And those, therefore, there are two more variables, Xi mu and Zeta mu, and unfortunately there's going to be several of these. I'm going to have to basically go through all one of these intersections. And those two are actually going to be part of the definition of inference. Okay? Next, the question that the scientist is asking, that they're trying to give an answer to, that one also arises. And then finally, the scientist exists in the universe. Their brain, your brain is part of the universe, it's part of the same universe, it's got the apparatus and so on. So the question you're asking and the answer you're giving, which are questions and answers about the observation apparatus, all of these are projections of the world line of the universe. They're all living in the same sandbox. So we got all these things. We got S of T2, which is what we want to know. We got the way that the observation apparatus is initialized and then what it pops out. We've got every possible question that the scientist, every possible question the scientist might want to know. We've got the actual question the scientist is asking, which is that capital Q of U. And then finally, we've got the answer that the scientist actually is given. So every one of these things that I went through, I will claim that in every instance of observation or prediction or memory, all those do arise. And we can actually go through this process of asking these questions for all possible values of L and giving an answer. Not saying yet that answer is correct or not, but you can always use that device. Okay? This is what successful inference would then mean. It would mean that for any question, actually, it's not even physical English, for any general question saying, is S of T2 equal to L? It's saying that I can actually set up an observation apparatus state, psi of U, together with a question in the scientist's head, such that whenever the apparatus is set up that way and the question in the scientist's head is the one that we want to know, then the scientist's conclusion is correct. That's a successful observation. It's a successful prediction. That's where we're closing the infinite regress.
But can I just ask, what is the U again?
That's the world line of the universe.
So that's a set of numbers.
It's just a set, right?
And of all the states of all the A, S's and A's and everything. And
across all time.
For all time, okay.
Yeah.
Even in the future, so even greater than T2.
And in the past. And in the past. So again, I'm just the messenger, not the message. This is a bit of a messy beast. Even so, I would actually say that one can argue that there's many, many aspects of observation that this does not try to formalize. There's many things that people would commonly say is prediction that this does not try to formalize. But I would say, conversely, flipping it around, that whenever we observe something, whenever you say you've got an observation apparatus, I can very easily go through and identify every single one of these things. And you can always go, and if it's a successful observation, probability measures under this thing, but if it's a guaranteed successful observation, I would say that way, right, probably one, then that property is always going to be true. And similarly, if it's a successful prediction. Okay? Now, I can do a little bit of simplification. It was before pointed out, I forget, by somebody or other in the audience, that these two things, actually, the question in the scientist's brain and how the output on the observation apparatus, those actually you can combine into a single variable. There's no reason to distinguish those. And when you do that, you get this. You've got the Q and the psi. Actually, that's the next stage. Never mind. I'm still back here. Yeah, still talking about how weak this is as a definition of inference, how much it does not presume about the real process. It is not being required here, for example, that the question in the scientist's head is actually the one that we are trying to have them answer. In other words, you get credit for the answer you put down on the quiz, even if you were mistaken about what question it was that you're answering. Nowhere is that being claimed. It allows you to actually initialize the observation apparatus, the inference device, in any way you want to. You can even initialize it with the correct answer. And this formalism doesn't care. There's no restrictions on the power of the observation device or the scientist. They can be super Turing, whatever you want. Speed of light and things like this impose any kinds of restrictions whatsoever. Nor on the coupling between the system you are, quote, observing and the observing device. There can be lots of coupling. There can be couplings to the extent that we would normally consider that to be actually control rather than observation. But there can be no coupling. None of that actually comes into this. That's how weak the definition this actually is. There's many, many aspects of observation that we would normally want to also formalize This one allows them to be whatever you want. The weakness of this definition, of course, means that the impossibility results that come out of it are that much stronger. Okay. So here then is that simplification that I was alluding to. And this then is inference. You've got a gamma of mu, which is what it is that you want to infer, S of T2. You've got an initial, you've got an initialization phase, which is the state of the scientist's brain when they have the question. And it also has to do with what's going to be coming out of the apparatus. You've got that question which concerns the apparatus. And you've got the output of the scientist. And then this is what successful observation means. That for any question which concerns the actual state of the world, I can set up the brain of the scientist and the observation errors can run through so that the scientist actually answers it correctly. That's the semantic meaning, as I was using the word before. Question?
I apologize that I've gotten confused. Would you be willing to put up, maybe on the blackboard, a brief dictionary of the chi's and the capital Q's?
Yeah, let me go back. I've struggled with this so many times to try to make it be sensible. Let's see, I guess there's no dictionary per se. Let me just run through it again. Gamma is S of T2, so that's the state of what it is that you want to observe at the time you want to observe it, or predict it, as the case might be.
For my purposes, as you go on, I'm going to forget what you're saying right
now.
Yeah,
I know.
That's why I was asking if you could put it on the blackboard.
Maybe here's a basic question. Why do you write gamma of u equals S of T2? What's the purpose of changing notation, making some substitution?
Oh, the crucial thing is to point out that all of these are going to be functions of the exact same u. That's the crucial point.
And what is u?
U is the world line of the universe.
What do you mean by the world line of the universe?
All variables across all time that comprise the universe. So it's everything in your head, everything that characterizes the things that you might want to observe, the future and the past, everything about me, and so on and so forth.
So u is the state of the universe for all times. And gamma of u is something that extracts out the state of this system S.
Yes, at time T2.
At time T2.
Exactly so.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I should have been making that clearer.
So again, I can, whenever I see gamma U, I can just say S of T2.
Yeah.
Whenever I see chi, I can just say A. Whenever I see that squiggle, I can say A of T3, all the way down.
All the way down, yeah. Should I just write these on the whiteboard for when I go on? Okay, so where? So there, an eraser. One more, try to just pop this up. Okay, so gamma of u. What we want to know. Chi of u is A of T1. How device initialized, though in the case of memory, it's actually after the fact. Then there was zeta of u, which was the output of the observation device. And this Q sub L, which if you notice, its argument is different. It's basically just a delta function. This is the thing that's saying, this is the thing that runs through all those binary questions.
So the reason you've renamed S and A and so forth is because eventually you're going to change T1 and T2 and T3. You're going to change positions so you can do prediction.
They can be anything. Time becomes irrelevant.
Okay.
Time all becomes irrelevant. Q of U.
So explain that one a little bit better. QL of gamma. So what is L?
L is, remember, there are all these possible value things that you might ask.
Okay, and gamma is, the little gamma is what?
And gamma is any possible state of your system. Where did it go?
So that's the dictionary.
Where was it? Did you just pass it?
No.
Here is L is that value K or K prime. Here it is. Here's L.
Okay.
And this is the Q sub L. I am actually, I mean, it looks like a messy beast. It doesn't look like it is a messy beast, but all it really is just taking all the stuff that, for the most part, people signed off on, and just putting it down in notation.
Q sub L is just like a delta between L and gamma.
Yeah, essentially so. Except that I don't want to worry about the actual spaces underneath. Everything can be cast in terms of sets. That's why I'm not writing the gamma function as a delta function. And where we got into. Then there was Q sub U, which is the scientist question that Chris was referring to, equals a scientist question.
Gamma is the same thing as S of T?
Sorry?
Gamma is the same thing as S.
Yes. Yes, gamma runs over the possible, or also actually of the apparatus. Let me see that in just a second. And then it's a Y of U is the scientist's answer.
So one and two are definitions. Three, it seems, is the condition for successful inference. In other words, if QL of gamma is equal to one, if and only if gamma is equal to L.
No. That's just the definition of the delta functions in this broader space. It may have been simpler if I just said, you know, everything is, say, finite, and these would be Kronecker deltas or something like that. If I just used the notation of the delta function and said, you know, overloading of operators, so to speak.
Right. But we could have a situation where the scientist, when he asks his questions, like, is S of 2 equal to L? He actually, so suppose that S of T2 is actually equal to 3, but when the scientist asks various questions, if he asks the question, is it equal to 3, he gets the answer no. And when he asks the question, is it equal to 5, he gets the answer yes. That would be failed inference. And in that case, we would have a QL of gamma that was not equal to the delta function. So that's why I'm saying it seems as if line 3 there is, that is the condition. If line 3 is true, then we have done successful inference. Otherwise,
No, line 3 is just a way of defining these things. So the notion is, remember the scientist ran through and said, does it equal k? Does it equal k prime? Does it equal k double prime? All of those things, k, k prime, k double prime, those are L's.
Right.
And so successful inference is when I can say for any such question, for any such k, for any such question that I might want to know, you can set up the scientist, make the scientist think that he's answering some question and set up the observation device in some way such that that scientist, by luck perhaps, gives an answer that's actually the truth for that particular question. So gamma of U is something. The stock market next week is 11,000. Q of L runs over all possible questions concerning that. Is the stock market next week 11,000? Yes. The stock market next week 10,500, no, so on and so forth. And the point is that for any such question, you can make the scientist consider some question, might even be different, and set up his computer in some way that might actually be wacky, such that perhaps by luck, his computer's prediction is going to be correct for that question and for any such question.
And what's the difference between gamma and S?
Gamma of U is just S at time T2. That's just the one thing that he wants to predict. So let me actually run through this then, just for the case of the stock market. For the stock market, S of T2 is 10,000 next week. Chi of U is how I'm setting up my laptop now to this week. Zeta of U is what my laptop is going to say tomorrow. Q of L runs over all possible questions I might want to ask about what the value of the stock market is going to be. 10,000, 10,001, so on.
Is Q of L just your notation for the Dirac measure on possible states in the system?
Well, it's a delta function, yeah. But I'm just using it, this notation, the only reason I'm using it this way is because there's actually nothing down about what the underlying sets are. So So if you want to think of it, it's a set theoretic delta. It's just it's a mapping from, well, it is what it is. So yeah, it's a delta function. Q of u, in this particular case of prediction in the stock market, that would be my knowing, so the state of my neurons, saying that when I'm setting up my computer now, the question I have in mind is such and such. And then y of u is whatever I then read off of my computer tomorrow. Okay. Now, again, the crucial thing is that for any instance of observation or prediction, there are all these five beasts. And whenever it's successful, this property does hold. There might be many other variables as well. There might be many other properties required as well. But at a minimum, there's this.
There's nothing about the relation between Q and A of T1 and Y and A of T3. Simply.
One could add those in as well, but what I'm going to be showing is that even with this simple stuff, which, as I was saying here, and as you're alluding to now, there's tons of things about observation and prediction that we might reasonably want to require that this simple definition, definition does not. There's still going to be all kinds of impossibility results and so on. Okay? So now we can get on to the fun stuff, I hope. Okay, so pulling it all together, an inference device is just a pair of functions. One of them is that function x, which is this combined with that. It's the question in your head combined with what your head is actually going to observe. And then the other thing, the other function, is going to be what your answer is. So you've got some set of all possible world lines of the universe, that's all they use. And then I'm just going to slap down two functions. There's nothing in here about time anymore to get to your issue, Chris. Just two arbitrary functions. And I'm just going to simply say that this device weakly infers some particular function, gamma, S of T2, if this condition holds.
So it's actually three functions. C is chi, q, and y. And then you define x to be chi and q.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. Again, I try to simplify, and I apologize. If I were in the audience right now, this would just look like a mess. But I will state that this is always the case, that you will never do anything that you consider to be a successful observation if you don't actually have this condition called with these variables. And as I said, usually many, many more besides. Okay, so given that mess, here's some elementary properties. For any function, for anything you might want to know, say the stock market next week, you can always create a device that does successfully predict, observe, whatever that function. However, you can also go the other way. Once you fix the device, you can always define a function over that space, an observable, that that device cannot observe. And there's nothing under here about the cardinalities of these spaces used, nothing at all. It's completely general and set theoretic. Okay? Here's another thing. Inference need not be transitive. I can have this laptop and have it be able to correctly predict what's in the state of Chris's laptop. And Chris's laptop can correctly predict what's on the state of Steve's. That does not mean that mine can correctly predict Steve's. OK? So here's what that sort of means in English. The fact that I can, for any inference device, always actually come up with a function that it cannot infer. This is all true for any kind of universe. We're not relying here on quantum mechanics, chaos, infinite sizes, anything. That means that Laplace was wrong. Even with what he knew then, because there's no sophisticated mathematics under this, even with what he knew then, he should have been able to prove that he was wrong. For any recording apparatus, because that's another kind of inference device, there's always some past event that you cannot guarantee that it can actually recollect correctly. And then this sort of non-quantum mechanical uncertainty principle. For any observation apparatus, I can always find something that I cannot guarantee that it's observing correctly. These don't have to be Hilbert spaces underneath it, or observation needs to have anything to do with eigenkets or any of that stuff. This is just based upon what it is that we need in the real physical world to do it.
So these are independent. It sounds like you can have one, two, but not three or two.
These are all true.
They're all okay.
Every single one of these is true.
These look like very strong statements given the...
Yes. Yes.
I don't even have a clue how you would get to them from the...
Here's what they get. It's all because these are all defined over the same space. This is where it's crucial. This is this, in addition to getting rid of time, the power of where you're on these things is all functions you, is you're basically saying, here is just some box. And there's some function gamma. And we start off with one when you say device calling like a gamma. You start off, you specify for me the x and the y. So I've just got some box, and you're going to specify some functions where y is binary valued, and x can be anything valued. And then the question is, can a devil's advocate come in and then come up with some other kind of a function over that space so that this property doesn't go through? And it's a demonstration proof, in essence. I can just go through it. I can show you that I can always construct that kind of function. What it amounts to sort of intuitively would be something like this. You've got a prediction device. What it wants to predict is whether the future state of the universe would be the one that's consistent with its current prediction being wrong if you were to evolve the universe forward in time. It's diagonalization proofs of that sort. There is some, in other words, there is some subset of current states of the universe in which that device's prediction could turn out to be wrong, and is trying to predict whether it is in that, within that space or not. So that's the kind of game that's played. Okay, so all these is independently correct.
So are you going to present the proof of that, the critical statement number two on the previous slide, or?
On that one? No, I can do that afterwards. There's a lot of stuff.
Okay, because I'm observing that seems to be very...
Yeah, you haven't really started yet, have you?
I'm literally only getting going. Yeah, it's always all that machinery is always difficult. That's just the foothills, and you can get tripped up in it. If I don't present it, then people, it's not clear why this is all motivated, right? It doesn't matter how good I'll be good. But the really fun stuff is yet to come, actually. Okay, so those are the impossibilities. And again, about all the weakness. There's no requirement in any of this that the actual scientists know what question is even being asked. You get credit if you're lucky. On the other hand, there's no restriction on the information being fed into the device. The observation device can actually be fed as part of the way it's initialized with the correct value of what it's trying to observe. There's no restriction on the coupling. The observation can actually amount to control, as we would colloquially use the phrase. The simulator, in the case of prediction, it can actually come to its conclusion after the event that it's looking at, because time doesn't arise in any of this. No restriction on the Chomsky hierarchy, on power of your device, or anything like that. Okay, so that's all considering a single device. Where things start to become interesting, where you get the mathematical structure that's analogous to what comes out of self-reference, when you're talking about computational systems in the Chomsky hierarchy, here the analogous structure is where you talk about relationships between multiple devices. So you start worrying about things where I'm trying to infer what Lee is concluding while Lee is trying to observe what Steve has just predicted. Then you start to get a graphical relationship between different observations that can be done by different observation apparatuses. In a certain sense, that is then going to be formalizing what a law of physics can have, because you're talking about what sets of things can be simultaneously or that's almost simultaneously, but not time, but what things can be observed. So, to do that, the first thing you have to talk about is whether two devices are distinguishable. I've got a laptop here, Chris has a laptop there. What we have to distinguish, we have to be careful about is, does the way that I set up my laptop, is it the case that it actually controls the state of Chris's laptop? Or are they actually independent laptops? To define them to be independent laptops means that however my device is actually initialized, Chris's can be arbitrarily initialized at the same time into any set, into a set of ways that his can be, and vice versa. So in other words, there's no way that I can initialize my device that would restrict the number of ways that Chris can initialize his device. They're completely distinct in that sense. That was not my phrase to call it a monotheistic theorem. It turns out that of any set of distinguishable devices, it might be that one device can infer the other ones, which means to predict what the other ones are going to do. But you can have at most one. And control, as I said, is a version of inference. So that means, if you want to get glib about it, let's say there were a deity who goes about and controls, observes, and predicts. And there are a bunch of deities. You could have one who can control, observe, and predict all the others, but at most one. And then there's all kinds of graph theoretic things you can start to do about whether you can have cycles in these things and stuff like that. I'm supposed to finish this time.
10 minutes.
Okay, let me try to scoot through that. Okay, so obviously I'm just now giving the flavor of these kinds of other attributes of all this. One of them is, okay, so that result about no two devices, the monotheism theorem, quote unquote, what that really is sort of the analog of is the halting theorem in computer science. You can then start to worry about things like, which would be the analogs of universal Turing machines. And you can talk about the analogs here in inference devices. What that would mean is that one inference device that can actually, in a certain sense, emulate other inference devices. And that is defined as strong inference. And tick, tick, tick. It turns out that you can prove that no two devices can strongly infer one another. In other words, no two devices can emulate one another independent of concerns about whether they are distinguishable or not. So you don't have to actually say that they're separate devices to say that there is that kind of a restriction. And a very important point, again, this is not my terminology, but it turns out, how to phrase it, consider this laptop at two separate moments in time, now and next week. Remember, the definition of a device has to do with the projections of the state of the world lines which are extending across all time. So this device now is a different device from this device next week. They are different projections of the world line of the universe. In one case, you're projecting the world line of the universe to the state of the variables now. In the other case, it's a projection to the state of the variables next week. So they're actually two separate devices. Okay? This, the result about how you cannot have two devices that can strongly infer one another, that means that this same device might be able to infer what it will do in the future, but if so, you can't go backwards. So if you could have a device, so again, it may or may not be that our particular universe allows there to be a device that can strongly observe, predict, control all other ones. But if there is one, if there's one that's got that extra ability to emulate, it could only have done that once, at one moment in time. So not only in a certain very, very glib sense could you only have one deity, but it could only have really been a deity once. Theism. It had to have set up the universe and then let it go. These can all be viewed as, in a certain sense, as just elaborations of Liar's paradoxes and things like that.
Yeah.
No, no.
I actually, who was that one? There may have been William Dembski, I'm not sure. Who's a creationist? I'd have to go back to my emails. There's a bit of a, been a lot of flurries about this stuff. So anyway, you can use some graph theoretic stuff with all these, and then an important point at the end. Did you like that one right there? Is you can also define, as I was mentioning, a version. Once you have strong inference, remember that's the analog of a universal Turing machine. So just as with universal Turing machines, you can define algorithmic information complexity. So with a device that can strongly infer other ones, you can define an inference complexity. And you can go on and you can calculate some things about it. And the crucial point is that because of that intelligent design theorem, because you could only have one device at most that could strongly infer all others, the implication is that if there is such a device in our universe, if it does allow it, if our universe has a God, then that actually will specify a unique measure of inference complexity, namely how complex the calculation is for that one device that can infer all others. So there's no arbitrary translation constant between different universal Turing machines. And that's a very big if. It's completely unknown about whether our universe is, you know, whether quantum mechanics, Hamiltonians can actually support such a thing.
What is, I mean, I'm kind of losing some things here, but what's that? Well, how do you define the complexity of an inference device?
It's got to do with basically, to define the complexity, you've got to put down a volume over the space of ways of space x's. How can we set up? And so the complexity of a particular prediction for this laptop is basically going to be the negative of the logarithm of the volumes that I have to circumscribe and state in right now to be able to guarantee that's going to make the prediction correctly.
The state chi, for example, right, and how the device is initialized, depends upon you, which is the entire universe.
Exactly.
So where is the volume there?
Oh, I've got to introduce a volume measure.
So it's the volume of the entire universe?
No. It's the volume that is the volume of those. It's the volume of the states of the universe that are, I need to invoke. And the states of the universe has to be in to be able to cause it, the prediction to be correct.
Right.
So for me to actually, so in other words, the intuition is that a prediction is complex if I've got to restrict the state of my laptop to very, very few possible states, very, very small volume, a small set of consistent universes to be able to make that prediction. And I'm way over time, and I guess I'll have to end it there. I didn't even get time to get to when you put a measure and so on. I apologize, I should have found some way to get past encryption keys at the very beginning so we could have gotten some of the other stuff. So anyway, that is a summary of some of the things with inference devices.
Now for the tough questions.
Yeah.
Well, I should apologize for asking so many questions earlier, but instead I'll ask another one now.
Okay.
This stage of the talk said that we have successful inference if, essentially, we always get the right answer.
Whether by luck or other means, for any possible question. Yeah.
If I relax that on a discrete system, on a questions with discrete answers to allow my inference process to be wrong occasionally, or if I relax it for continuous answers to allow it to be off by a little bit, how does that affect the theological theorems later on?
it seems to have some very major effect on some of them, but not others. That's an extremely good question. What happens when you slap down a probability measure over the space U? That is just being explored by me and some collaborators, extremely early days. The other thing that you just went to, which is extremely important, is again, essentially no thought, which is what if it's just not a matter of am I wrong or am I right, but how much am I wrong or am I right? Throw down not just a measure, but a metric, which certainly if you're going to be getting to things like the observation paradox, you're going to want to have some kind of a metric, say how far is it? You have real value observations, momentum is a real number, and so on. There's been essentially no work on any of that so far. And so what its implications might be is completely unknown. Also, more generally, if you start to actually make the structure richer, so it actually added more of the other conditions that are behind things like observation and so on and so forth, what happens to all these theorems?
So why did the past get it wrong? So if it was something like, was he thinking something like if his demon was independent of the universe, is he somewhere else, and then it could then know everything about a separate universe from itself, but nothing about its interaction with the universe or something like that?
Yes, this exactly so. This is what the crucial problem is that the demon is in the same universe that's trying to make predictions about.
Yeah.
And so therefore you can simply ask to make predictions about the future state of the universe that are going to in some way be contingent upon it, the demon's current state. So that what, however it might try to set up its current state to make a prediction, it's going to be thwarted. Because you're going to ricochet from the past back to the present.
But it could make predictions. Say that, so what could it do then? So what are the limits? So it could predict everything which was somehow uncorrelated to the world.
Well, it's not even a matter of uncorrelated. It's because it's in the same universe. The point is that once you specify the demon, you can then place devil's advocate. And once you specify the demon in the universe, you can then play devil's advocate and go into that universe and find something that the demon cannot correctly infer.
But it would always be something that involves the state of the demon as well.
Well, in a certain sense, but except that here there's actually no distinction between observer and observee. These are just arbitrary functions across world lines. These are just partitions of sets. And so it's not necessarily clear where the demon ends. The device could be the entire universe in a certain sense. Some subset of the degrees of freedom across all space and time. And what it's trying to observe could be some other subset, or anything along those lines. So it gets much more amorphous even than that, much more powerful than that.
This non-quantum uncertainty principle, is there some restrictions you can place on these things, which such that you can avoid this uncertainty principle?
It's not clear what happens when you go to measure theory. Let me go to my very last slide. Actually, that's not the most efficient way to get there. And just give a little result. This is close. Yeah. This is a little result that's known that's got to do with these kind of things. Say you've got a two devices, and where the way that they, each of them can be initialized is just binary. Okay? Then let's say that, and this has got to do with, I've got some, and I'm going to have an arbitrary probability measure across the space. So I'm actually going to modify the definition of infer to mean infer with an accuracy of epsilon. So in other words, once I got a probability measure, it's not just a matter anymore of can I guarantee that I'm always correct or not, which is what it was all about before. Now it's a matter of can I guarantee that the probability of my being correct is at least as good as this or not. So you go through a very, very simple such situation. What you end up with is that if there are two devices that are distinguishable, then across all possible probability measures, the product of their accuracies is bounded above by 1/4 in this particular very, very simple situation.
So, I mean, is there, you have these general definitions. Is there some sort of simple axiom you can you can postulate, which gives you the operational formalism for quantum theory, or
oh man, that's what this right now is so seductively trying to say. But I think that to actually go at that, one has to not only figure out properly how to get probability measures in there, but also things like the measure of how close you are. It's not just even the probability of accuracy, because uncertainty principle and so on, well, actually you could state in terms of spin rest, in terms of spins. But certainly if you want to do things like position momentum, you need to actually be able to quantify how close I am. So one has to superimpose upon this a metric, well, some kind of a distance measure, seems to be a metric, as well as some kind of a probability measure. And what can come out of that? Boy, that would really be cool if somehow something about quantum mechanics comes out of that. You're not even assuming anything about linear spaces underneath this. On additivity of Hilbert vectors, right?
We should probably thank David again.
Okay.